Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording in the early hours of the morning of August 30th, 2013. This is Nav Briefing number 83, Black Jaguar Rising. I'm going to take somewhat of an unusual tack in this briefing. While I will continue to concentrate on the immediate navigational parameters, particularly the Venus-Saturn conjunction of September 18th, I'd like to delve into the mythological background of those celestial events. And so, I take this opportunity to talk about the cycle of Venus and the mythological theme of the descent of the goddess into the underworld. Doing so, I'm going to refer specifically to the Maya lore, the Maya mythology and astronomy, referring to Venus. As you may know, the planet Venus played a role of tremendous significance in Mesoamerican mythology, and particularly in the Mayan and Aztec cultures, and most certainly in the Toltec culture that preceded them. And one of the most famous artifacts surviving from the Holocaust that was perpetrated in Central America by the conquistadores and the Catholic Church is the Dresden Codex, which contains a remarkable record, precise in great detail, of the periodic cycles of Venus. And in particular, it describes and computes the appearances of Venus in the morning and in the evening sky. Such appearances were considered to be powerful omens by the ancient Maya and the Aztec, and they were most significantly connected with war. They were considered to be omens of war. So what we are now looking at in the evening skies of the fall of 2013 is the glorious appearance of Venus as the evening star. She's been visible for a while after sunset in the west. As I said in the previous briefing, she's now approaching Saturn and will be in exact conjunction with Saturn on the 18th of September. And then she will continue, that will be on the borderline between the Virgin and the scales. And then she will continue to move through the scales and toward the Scorpion. And as she does so, she will mount higher and higher in the evening sky until she reaches what is called her maximum elongation, that is to say, her maximum separation from the sun. As far as I can see, she will reach that point of maximum height in the sky around the middle of November. Interestingly, quite close to the time when the sun itself will pass into the area of the starry sky that represents the fulcrum of the scales. Of course, the sun, as it stands at the fulcrum of the scales in mid-November, will not be visible, but in the sky after sunset, Venus will be seen at her highest position and maximum elongation. Then from that point, she will slowly begin to descend until she approaches the sun, and then she passes into the period of invisibility, which has been symbolically described as her descent into the underworld. Now Venus, who was called Xochiquetzal in the Maya Yucatec language, Xochiquetzal, was not the only mythological astronomical figure known to make this descent. If you look along the lines of comparative mythology, you find that there are numerous legends of the descending goddess. For instance, Ishtar in Akkadian and Babylonian mythology descended into the underworld. And the story and the myth associated with the astronomical event of Venus's descent, as viewed by the Babylonians, is quite complex. It's quite a complex and elaborate story, the descent of the goddess Ishtar. And quite often, when this occurs in one myth or another, in one culture or another, there is a second goddess figure connected with the descent event. For instance, the Babylonian myth of Ishtar records that when she reached the gates of the underworld, she had to be received by the queen of the underworld, who was called in Akkadian Ereshkigal. Likewise, you find the same theme repeated in another variant in the story of Persephone. Persephone was a goddess who descended into the underworld, although the story is told in an abduction format. And so Persephone is also a second name attached to the same female divinity. When she was alive and well in the world above, she was called Kor or Kore, the daughter of Demeter. Then when she descended, she was called Persephone. So you find this common theme that there are two names sometimes identified in the narrative of the myth as two distinct goddesses, but in fact they are merely two aspects of one single goddess. Likewise, in the Maya Yucatec legends that survive, Xochiquetzal, which is the name of the Maya Aztec Aphrodite, assumes another name when she descends into the underworld, which is called in Mesoamerican mythology Xibalba. And that name for Venus in the underworld is Xibalanque. Xibalanque is the black jaguar. But before she descends, she rises. Before Venus makes or takes the course on her orbital path that brings her into her underworld descent, she rises to her highest point in the evening sky. And what I wish to indicate to you at this moment is the importance to observe the ascent of Venus preceding her descent. And so the theme to carry in your mind, in your imagination, as you observe the sky for the next 4 months, is the theme of black jaguar rising. And at every moment that you consider this theme and nurture this theme in your second attention, that is with your dreaming attention, your imagination, remember that you have the opportunity to go out and look at the evening sky and raise your eyes after sunset and use your first attention to actually witness black jaguar rising. And I want to emphasize that this ritual, which now begins at the signal moment of the Venus-Saturn conjunction, this ritual is a powerful ritual more powerful than you might perhaps be able to comprehend until you actually go through it. I would describe this ritual of observing the ascending Venus in comparison with the meditative techniques that are proposed for the highest stages of Tibetan Tantra. I mean specifically in Dzogchen, the two meditative techniques that belong to the practice of deity yoga. And those techniques are called the generation and perfection practices. So what happens in the generation and perfection practices of Ati Yoga or Dzogchen at the highest levels of that practice? Well, I may have spoken of this before. Anyway, I'll give you a brief paraphrase. The generation practice, or generation stage as it's called, requires the person in meditation to form a graphic and detailed visual figure of a certain deity. Let's say, for example, that this deity is called the Yidam. That is the focus of the concentration in this exercise of visualization. So let's say that you undertake a generation practice on Kurukula. In that case, you would picture in your mind the image of Kurukula as a naked dancing Dakini with her flowered bow and her arrow that she's shooting from the bow. And you would visualize the environment around her, the icons surrounding her, and you would visualize her position, her body, the color of her body, other ornaments that she wears, bracelets, earrings, the finest details. And you would immerse yourself in this visualization, this graphic visualization of Kurukula, until you were able to reproduce it in your mind in the form of a holographic imprint, a holographic construct. That is called the generation stage or generation practice. Following that comes the perfection stage, which we simply call in planetary tantra completion. And in the perfection stage, the individual who has created this holographic construct of Kurukula and who has been able to maintain it vividly intentionally dissolves the image. And there is various techniques described of how to do this, but basically you dissolve that holographic image into a drop. And then you draw that drop toward yourself and allow that drop to drop into your body, into the subtle anatomical structure of your body, and to pass into the third channel of your body, as they call it. This is the exercise in the so-called perfection stage. And according to the claims of the Tibetan Buddhists, if you do this correctly, there will be a series of spectacular effects within your bodily or organism, not to mention your mind and your emotions. But it will produce a rush of bliss. It will produce the ecstatic impressions of nectar flowing through your cells, through the channels, the right and left channels, and the central channel of the subtle anatomy of your body. And it will also produce siddhis. You will spontaneously acquire siddhis or occult powers. That is to say, you will be able to perceive things at a distance. You will have clairaudience, you will have other occult powers. So that, in a nutshell, is the practice of generation of the generation and perfection stages of Ati Yoga. I've spoken to a few people in my life who have spent many years devoted to those difficult and elaborate practices. And so far as I know from the testimony of people that I've met, that they have not been able to achieve any of the promised results. But I can assure you that the practice that you undertake with me now in the GNE is as good as generation and perfection could be, and probably a hell of a lot better. For one thing, you are going to undertake the parallel or the equivalent to the generation and perfection exercises, not sitting in meditation in some room, not in some condition of narcissistic isolation, not gazing into space to produce a holographic visual image of something. You are going to perform the equivalent of that tantric practice interactively with the sky. And the sky is a user-friendly medium that is going to provide for you the observational content that is a substitute for the holographic image that you would produce. Therefore, you don't even have to strain yourself. And it is apparently an enormous strain to try to pull off these Tibetan tantric exercises. So what is the generation phase and what is the perfection phase of this exercise I'm now proposing that we undertake in the GNE? I prefer to say generation and completion, by the way, so from now on I'm going to say generation and completion. The generation stage consists of the time that you pass day after day to observe the ascent of Venus in the sky. You use your first attention to pick out Venus in the sky each night, and you use your observational power to discern how she is higher every evening and how she moves against the background of certain constellations. That's the generation phase. At the same time, you bring to that observation whatever content of your imagination is appropriate. Your imagination, acting through the medium of your self-conscious, which is kind of like a butterfly valve in the second attention, will itself introduce or suggest to you mythological imagery. So think about Ishtar in her descent. Think about the beauty of Ishtar as a love goddess and a war goddess, and Aphrodite as well, because Ishtar is merely the Babylonian Aphrodite. Likewise, for Xochiquetzal, she is both an erotic goddess of love and pleasure, not fertility, and she is a war goddess. We're not talking about fertility goddesses here. We're talking about goddesses of erotic power and pleasure who are also, in some way, war goddesses. Venus is both. And the ascent of Venus to our high point in the middle of November is an omen of war. But it is not an omen of the ordinary war being fought on the world stage. It is the omen of the war undertaken by the Kalika War Party. The war undertaken against those who would harm the Anthropos and do harm to this divine experiment. And I'm going to call that war that is now kicking into action the Bhairavi offensive of the Kalika warriors. So as you are watching Venus rise and get brighter and brighter in the night sky, you charge your imagination in any way you can with the images of the Kalika war party and the images of Bhairavi, Durga, Kali, standing at the head of that party and leading the party into her offensive against those who are the enemies of the divine Sophia and the enemies of the Antipos and the enemies of life itself. The practice of generation in the Tibetan Tantric scheme is a practice, obviously, of charging. What the meditation or the person in meditation does with the holographic visualization is to charge that with devotion, to charge it with their attention. And then when it comes to the completion stage and that visualization is dissolved into a bindu or drop and taken into the body, all of the power that was put into the charge is released into the body. So what is the completion phase of our tantric act of meditation in the sky? Well, that is simply the phase that occurs when Venus swings around in retrograde and descends into the underworld and disappears. The descent of Venus, the descent of Black Jaguar, is the equivalent to the completion phase in the Tibetan Tantric practice, you see? And so it is actually Venus herself, the planet Venus, in the solar system, who completes the meditation for us. And then when she emerges in the morning sky, after having been in the underworld for a certain period of time, that is to say, no longer observable from the earth, she carries forth the fruits and powers of completion. So I want to invite you all to do as I shall be doing and proceed with this ritual in the 4 months ahead until the moment around December 21st when Venus turns retrograde and quite rapidly begins her descent into the underworld. And if you're wondering about the corresponding moment when she reappears in the morning sky, what time would that be? And where would she reappear? Against what constellation? And what would be the actual graphic signature or graphic manifestation of the completion of this ritual? Well, that would be in March of 2014, when Venus appears in the morning sky as the morning star, and she appears in the constellation of the goatfish. And that is the omen that Venus provides for our experiment and our journey, the specific omen of benevolence and power that she provides to us who follow this fantastic experiment. Now, before I talk a little more about the specifics of the Maya Aztec mythology, I'd like to relate a little experience I had recently. You know, I've been reading Carlos Castaneda, rereading Castaneda after many years. Doing so, I decided to jump in at the 5th book, The Eagle's Gift. I'm finding that it proves to be extremely relevant to things that are happening in the G&E right now, as well as things that are happening in my own adventures as a Nahual. You might recall that recently I mentioned I had the occasion to go on a telestic journey with my apprentice, Kundry. And we had a specific purpose to undertake this journey in the presence of certain genial allies from Colombia. I can't remember the exact day that we did this, but it was during this period of time of the summer coming into fall when it was easy to observe the ascent of Black Jaguar in the evening sky. And so the observation of Venus did constitute a most significant moment in this telestic session. So I'd like to relate to you two things about this telestic session that I undertook with Kundry. The first was our question. We discussed it. There's always pre-briefing with a telestic session. Pre-briefing is very important, as well as debriefing afterwards. But it's in the pre-briefing that you set the intention. You cannot have a telestic session without an intention. So we had been marveling over Sophia's Magnificat, as you all have likewise, and we had been marveling at the change, the enormous shift that came upon this planet after that moment of July 7th, when Sophia managed for the first time to combine and coordinate her first and second attention and direct them into the human mind. And so the question that we formulated was exactly this. How do we, the teleste of this moment, focus and augment your feat of accessing the human mind? This is how we formulated the question. We knew that she had already achieved this feat. We were living in the immense repercussions of her doing so. And so we wanted to ask simply how we, as modern teleste, could focus and enhance that intercession, that intervention. I believe we used the word intervention in the exact syntax. How can we focus and enhance your intervention into the human mind? And so we went into the telestic session with that precise question. And I'll tell you something about the planetary animal mother. Being an animal, she's extremely telepathic. And she can often read your mind and detect your question even before you state it. So we entered this exercise in the presence of and with the assistance of some Colombian allies, and these Colombian allies are most elegant emissaries to the organic light. And they'll take you right there pretty fast, and the rush is something. The rush is something. Something else. And so the rush came on, and following normal procedure, once the Nawal had established steadiness in the rush, because that is the role of the Nawal, once the Nawal finds steadiness in the rush for himself and makes sure that other participants are steady, then the moment comes when you pose the telestic question. I didn't even have to pose the question, because as soon as we got through the rush into a state of steadiness, which is like being in the still center of a turbulent vortex, the answer came. The answer came because Dayan Sophia read my mind and already detected what was in my mind. And the answer she gave was given in a very interesting syntax, which I noted was unusual, because she spoke of herself in the third person. Now, I can't recall her doing that before, but this is the answer she gave, and this is exactly the answer, word for word. Teach them the extinction protocols of the Scorpion Mother. Those were her exact words, referring to herself, of course, as the Scorpion Mother, but oddly referring to herself in the third person. And then there were two other short phrases that were attached to that response. Teach them the extinction protocols of the Scorpion Mother. And as soon as that answer came, and I shared it with my apprentice, we turned back to the light together with the natural response, which anybody would have in that situation, right? Okay, so what are the extinction protocols of the Scorpion Mother? And then she proceeded to download to us completely what they were. And then I proceeded to impart in spoken language the download to my apprentice. And I got a pretty complete set of the protocols of what we may now designate as the extinction protocols, and how to track the implementation of those protocols, the deployment of those protocols against certain movements in the sky. That all came in one, 15-second download? Fundamentally, I'm not going to unzip the instruction right here and now, because it would get in the way of what I would like to say in this briefing. But I will tell you that the timing is explicit. And what was indicated to me on that evening by instruction by the organic light is that the Scorpion Mother completes all of the necessary preparations for her extinction plan by the time that Saturn reaches Antares in the constellation of the Scorpion. You might observe that right now on Earth, there are certain geophysical and atmospheric events which appear to be dystropic and which could very well lead to massive dystropic conditions which would produce inevitable extinction of a greater part of the human species. And it is extinction of the human species that we're talking about here. Among those dystropic events are, of course, the enormous release of methane and other factors. There are so many of them that I haven't even been able to keep track of them. But those of you who are following these bizarre and anomalous geophysical events, such as the sinkholes, the volcanic eruptions outside the Rome airport, the enormous undersea cloud of iron being released along the Atlantic Ridge. I mean, it just goes on and on. You could sit down and do a few days' research and come up probably with 20 or so massive geophysical changes, which, were they allowed to run into a dystropic acceleration, which used to be called positive feedback, would most definitely and certainly and unfailingly produce conditions for mass extinction. And I'm telling you that the timing required for the complete preparation for mass extinction is marked by the arrival of Saturn at Antares in the heart of the Scorpion. So you can go check that out. Look it up on Stellarium or look it up in an ephemeris. That would be when Saturn reaches the 12th degree of the sign Sagittarius. So that was a pretty... We had some laughs about that, because you have to laugh, because this is really, really heavy stuff. And it's actually somehow lightens my spirit, usually, to tell you about this. There's no fear in anything that she would do, and anything that she will do. There's no fear in it, and nothing to be feared. But I'd like to relate, in connection with the Venus phenomenon, the Venus practice I described, I'd like to relate something unexpected that happened in the second part of that telestic seance. We were walking around, because you have to keep moving and walking, because the rush is just... It's like being in a blast of a beautiful fragrance that operates upon you like music, so that you can't be still. So you don't want to sit, you want to move, you want to dance. But we did kind of calm down a bit. We did mellow down, and we had a couple of hours of the session left. Well, what are we going to do? We got the whole question answered in the first hour of the session. So at a certain point, we were sitting on a terrace. We did it at the full moon, I remember. We were sitting on a terrace at Ambergane House. And I said to Kundry, you know, at the moment that we were standing there facing west and looking up at Venus, and the answer to the question came, I also got a message from the Colombian allies. I told her this while we were sitting there. And I said, they reminded me to remind myself of the sacred name of the Aztec love and war goddess, Xochiquetzal, of the sacred name that she assumes in her descent into the underworld. And I said, you know, this is a beautiful name, and it gives me enormous pleasure to pronounce it. And I said to Kundry, it gives me enormous pleasure to tell you this name, because this is a most beautiful name for invoking magic. And that name is Ishbalanque. That is the name of Venus in her descending phase. And so she immediately got it, and she said, yeah, well, that's sort of like, you know, the name that the goddess assumes in the underworld, like Persephone is an underworld name, Ereshkigal is an underworld name, right? This is the underworld name. So I went on to explain, and we were kind of doing it. I've never had a session quite like this before. We were kind of doing the debrief of the session while the session was still going on. And I said, well, you know, the Colombian allies said that they wanted to do a ceremony in our honor, and that the tutelary goddess of the ceremony was Ishbalanque, the black jaguar. And in order for... They were going to perform the ceremony right there while we were in the session. At least they were going to initiate the ceremony. That is to say, this non-human species, who are the emissaries on that occasion, to the organic light. Because you can talk to the species of the psychoactive plant that you ingest. Did you know that? You can talk directly to them. So I had these brief exchanges with them, and I immediately shared this with my apprentice, a westerly woman, as Castaneda would say, and a formidable stalker. But when she weaves, she's a dreamer. When she lives, she's a stalker. So I said, yeah, this is what they said. They're going to perform a ritual under the guidance of Ishbalanke, and they're going to do it for us and for the GNE. How's that? How do you like them potatoes? Or potatoes, as you would say in Maya. How do you like them potatoes? And so I said, and they asked me if we could do something to participate in the ritual. They saw that we were fearless warriors who do not need to be tested. They love that. You can tell them that, by the way, if it's true. Don't tell them if it ain't. But if you're a fearless warrior and you don't need to be tested, as soon as the rush comes on, you say telepathically to the plant allies, I am a fearless warrior. I do not need to be tested. I cannot be tested. That gives them one hell of a thrill, because then they can go right to the punch. It's boring for them to test people and take them through various filters before they introduce them to the organic light. So they knew that we could access the light, and they knew, obviously, that we could access it both visually and tactily. So what they asked is that we together would each take a filament strand of the organic light out of the matrix and put our fingers together and join the threads and give them that double thread. And that they would take that double strand of mycelium filament of the organic light into the underworld as a thread to follow the underworld descent of Xochitl Quetzal as she becomes Black Jaguar. And that's what we did. We sat on the terrace in a certain place where it was easy to see the matrices and lattices of the organic light, which had stabilized, so we weren't in the high turbulence of the high rush that you get. We were in the middle turbulence and the mellowing out point of perception of the light. And so I showed Kundry a certain mudra, which is called the mudra of the beak. It's when you put your index finger and the thumb of your hand together and squeeze them out so that you form the shape of an eye. But at the same time, the close positioning of the thumb and finger form a beak, like the beak of a goose. And the technique of pulling a strand, a mycelium strand, out of the organic light involves that you gaze through the eye that is formed by that mudra, and you pick up one strand with your eyes, and then you draw it to your fingers, and then you open your fingers very, very slightly, and you hold it between your fingers. So I showed her how I did that, and then she repeated what I did. And then when we both had a mycelium strand of the organic light pinched in that way, without the fingers touching, we joined our two pinches and we handed off the dual thread to the allies, and they took it in the direction of the council tree and went underground with it. Now, I guess I don't have to elaborate the obvious. and tell you that that was an extremely outrageous thing to do. And it elicited outrageous pleasure to do that and to be able to do that. And from the moment that we did that together, and it was totally spontaneous, I hope that my account of it conveys to you that point, that it occurred and unfolded in a spontaneous way. Nothing was planned in advance. Nothing was preconceived. Well, from the moment of performing that exquisite ritual together, we found ourselves returning over and over again to the question of, like, what was this ritual, you know? And when we came out and of the trance, and in the following days, we were debriefing each other off and on, the question keep coming up, you know, like, wow, what were these allies doing, you know? How are we going to follow this ritual? What are they going to do with this thread that they've taken into the underworld? This dual thread that we handed to them as a component of their ritual. Naturally, we were in a great state of wonderment having done that, as you might well be. And to conclude this talk and to address that wondering, I'd like to cover a little historical account of things that happened in Central America relative to the theme of Black Jaguar Rising as we experience it today. I refer to an account of events, some recorded and some not, that transpired in the wake of the so-called conquest of Mexico by Hernando Cortes, the conquistador, and his band of syphilitic villains from Extremadura in Spain. Once again, the Spanish theme. Once again, Spain as the land of the European predators, as the beachfront of the European predators who attacked the New World. And the events to which I refer would be located in time, I would say, just around the middle of the 16th century, or around 1560, right after the so-called conquest of Mexico by Cortes and his syphilitic conquistadores from Extremadura, and the conquest of Peru by Pizarro and all that jazz. So we're looking into the middle of the 16th century there, right? 1550 or so. Something happened at that time, which was, of course, a massive genocide of the Native American peoples and the whole-scale destruction of the magical warrior cultures of Mexico and Central America. And one of the key figures in this genocidal massacre, not only of the people themselves, but of their culture and their magic, was a Spaniard called Diego Lalanda. And he lived from 1524 until 1579. And during that period of time, you know, I guess from the last 20 years of his life or whatever, he was stationed in the Yucatan. And it was his job, basically, to oversee the murder of the Maya Yucatec cultures, the Yucatec Maya, as they're properly called, and the complete destruction of their sacred culture and their sacred knowledge, including the burning of all their codices and so forth and so on. So what you find happening is that, and this is the proof that the premise of not in his image is correct, what you find happening is that Lalanda, who was Spanish and a European, and who was the descendant of peoples who had had their culture and indigenous spirituality destroyed by the salvationist virus, became himself the instrument of that same virus, because the victim-perpetrator cycle perpetuates itself. And so he went to the Yucatan and did the same thing to the native Maya people that had been done to his own people, the indigenous Iberian peoples, centuries before. Because in terms of the human subconscious, the memory of long centuries of events is very short and very compressed. And so as far as the human subconscious is concerned, the genocide perpetrated by Christians upon the native Iberians, who later became the Spanish, was only moments away from the genocide perpetrated by the Spanish upon the Native Americans, and so it goes. And so there was Bishop Lalanda, and he was very passionate and very righteous and pious about his mission, because he saw that these people were obviously devil worshippers. They had all kinds of elaborate rituals. They had many, many evil idols in all their temples. They were ingesting various kinds of plants that put them into trance, and all of this was just a horror to Bishop Lalanda. And so he endeavored with great ferocity and determination to wipe them all out. But an odd turn of events occurred, and that was that, the Jesuit order was founded in 1541. And that was when Lalanda was 17. And so by the time he was undertaking his mission in the Yucatan, the Jesuit order was up and running. And the Jesuits took a great interest in what was happening in Mesoamerica and all these cultures of the Maya and Aztec, these remote and exotic cultures. The Jesuits were interested in those cultures for the same reasons that they are interested in anything today, because they want to know how they can corrupt and undermine it, and how they can steal the magic, because they don't have any of their own. And so at a certain point in the communications that took place at that time via the Spanish galleons that were trucking the gold back to Spain and eventually to Rome via Sevilla, in the communications that went on between Lalanda and his handlers in Rome, he got the message, hey, wait, wait a minute, stop. Don't wipe them completely out, because we might be able to benefit from some of this magic that we have, and we could turn around and use it to terrorize the human race and achieve our own wicked ends. So don't destroy it. Let's see if you can salvage some of it. So Lalanda, at a certain point in his career, had to do an about-face, and he had to try to gather up and preserve some of the Maya lore rather than destroy it. Well, it was pretty late in the game by then. He had murdered most of the authentic shamans of the period, which were called Balams, which means jaguar as well. The Balams of that land were devastated, and the ones that had not been killed had been turned into drunks or converted, converted to the new faith. So it was pretty slim pickings by the time that he got these orders to reverse his policy. But he did manage to salvage some manuscripts, and you can read all about that in the Wikipedia article or any good book on the history of the conquest of the Yucatan. And one thing that happened, which you won't necessarily find written down, was that Diego got his hands on one of the well-known shamans who hadn't fled or been murdered or turned into a drunk or a devout Catholic, and insisted that this shaman recount to him certain mythological stories of their culture, so that he could write them down and send them back to Rome, so the Jesuits could turn around what they stole from the indigenous peoples and use it against them. Now there considerable detail in this story, but the basic thing I want to get across is that everybody knows that Lalanda wrote down the things that he learned in this manner in a book called Relación de las Cosas de Yucatán, which is considered to be the most complete treatment of Mayan religion that we're ever likely to have. And the manuscript contains Mayan hieroglyphs and things like this. So he was obviously advised, closely advised by the surviving informants that he could dig up at the time. Now this situation with Lalanda did not go unnoticed by the natives, and there were still some genuine shamans hiding in the jungle. And what Lalanda, the treachery of Lalanda to first try to destroy the sacred lore of the natives, and then to do an about face and try to retrieve the sacred lore of the natives, but only so that he and his Jesuit masters could use it against them, and who knows, against the entire world. You know, the Jesuits fancy themselves to be some sort of magicians, black magicians. They're quite proud of that. Well, that whole event didn't go very well and didn't set very well with the people of the time, and it festered in the memory of the Maya. So then what happened? Jump ahead about 100 years, and you come to another character, another Spaniard, in the story of the conquest of Central America, and that particular character was called, if I might just check this for sure, it was called Jimenez, right? Jimenez, Francisco Jimenez. And Francisco Jimenez was one of the successors of Lalanda, who actually retrieved and wrote down what is called the Popol Vuh, or Chilam Balam, the book, the popular book of the people, of the Maya people, but not particularly of the Maya of the Yucatan. More the contents of the Popol Vuh are drawn more from the sacred tradition of the Quiché Maya of Guatemala. Because what had happened at that time is that the last remaining genuine shamans who had any knowledge of magical lore and mythology and practice and astronomy had retreated into Guatemala, because there was a certain safety in Guatemala, and there were very powerful sites in Guatemala which were not discovered until after the Maya and Aztec sites were discovered in the 18th century. And those are incredibly powerful sites, the sacred cities and sanctuaries of Guatemala. So it was among the shamans of that area that Francisco Jimenez went to kind of repeat what Lalanda had done. However, the natives were a little more savvy about this game at that point. And so what happened was that the shaman who gave to Jimenez the account of certain elements in the Popol Vuh actually disguised and distorted the information that he gave. Now that shaman, who is perhaps unnamed, perhaps not, who survived among the Quiché of Guatemala, had to deliver under duress, you can picture the whole story, some of his sacred knowledge to this invader, to this salvationist monster. And couldn't get away without delivering something. And so there you find the content of the Popol Vuh, which is in certain respects quite reliable, but in others not so. Now why am I telling this story in the deep background of our history, but not that far back, you know? 400 or 500 years ago is not that far back. And I've often contended that the things that happened in the so-called conquest of Mexico and Peru have never yet been understood by anybody or by any historian whatsoever. And were they to be understood, they would cast tremendous light on events in the world today. But even better, they would provide a situation where retrieval is possible. The retrieval of that lore is possible, even though the artifacts and idols and codexes were destroyed. That retrieval is possible because the Mayan Aztec priesthoods followed a tradition they learned from the Toltecs, and that is, they learned to deposit and store their secret knowledge in kinds of holographic lattices called conicles, C-O-N-A-C-L-E-S. And these are actually holographic lattices in the organic light. And so you can imagine what access to those conicles would do. And access to those conicles may now become possible because of the return of the repressed and because of the unrepressing of the general subconscious of humanity. It's the repression of the subconscious of humanity by traumatic amnesia that makes it very, very difficult to access those conicles. But that could all change. And I wonder if one of the objectives of the Colombian plant teachers is to do just that. The sacred thread that they are taking into the underworld was put in the hands by two Teleste living in this time and moment. They requested that for a reason. I see that thread now as a symbol of a continuity of the most powerful, magical knowledge, the most powerful magical gnosis on this planet, which comes, by the way, from Central and South America, in case you didn't notice. Okay? Now, I'd just like to return to the detail of the account given by the Guatemalan shaman, which ended up in the Popol Vuh that was written down by Francisco Jimenez. Among the material in that work is one of the most famous stories in Mesoamerican mythology, and that is the story of the descent of the two twins into Xibalba, the descent of the two twins into the underworld. And these twins are called, first, Hunabhu, which means one blowgunner. Hu, you can hear it in the name. Hunabhu, Hu, one blowgunner. And his twin, Xibalanque. Now, scholars have observed that this word Xibalanque is an odd word and doesn't really quite fit. There are at least three proposed translations for the word Xibalanque, and what is puzzling about it is that it appears to be formed of the common word balam, meaning jaguar, but it has the prefix she in front of it, which is an X, and can also be pronounced Ishbalanque when it has an I in front of the X. And so is this Ishbalanque, Xibalanque character in the Popol Vuh is peculiar because the name is not right. And why is the name not right? Well, that's exactly where he fudged the story. As it comes down through Jimenez, these two twins, as they're called, the warrior twins of the Maya, of the Quiche Maya, are considered to be two brothers, two males, Hunabfu and Shibalanke. But that's not the real story. That's only the story that the unnamed shaman gave to the predator. What the unnamed shaman wanted to do in even giving any recount of this most sacred underworld myth was to leave a record that could be later deciphered, possibly, by others, shamans who were of an equal stature to him, to himself or herself. And so he both concealed the true meaning of this myth of the descent of the hero twins into Shibalba, but he also encoded in it a key to the true story, to the true tale that he wished to have told. And what is that true tale? Well, it's not what you read when you read all this stuff about the ball game and the beheading. And go read some version of this myth called The Descent of the Hero Twins from the Popol Vuh. It'll leave your head spinning. It doesn't really hang together. In plain English, it just doesn't work. You can't make anything out of it. And that's intentional. Because even though the unnamed shaman didn't want to give away the secret, he or she wanted in some way to transmit this secret forward in the event that in some future time the material of the Popol Vuh would come to the attention of shamans of equal accomplishment, then they would recognize the trick. And the trick is simple. The first shaman actually to catch on to that trick was Carlos Castaneda. And somehow or somewhere, in the course of his long career as a shaman and author of magical realism, he was able to catch the first glimmer of the real meaning of this myth of the descent of the hero twins. And you find that element in Castaneda in the fifth book. Recall that in the fifth book and in the sixth book, excuse me, I think I said the Eagle's Gift was the fifth book. The Eagle's Gift is the sixth book. So what you find in the fifth and sixth books of Castaneda's series is the emergence of the female warriors and the formation of the warrior party. This is described at length in the Eagle's Gift, whereby you have the stalkers and the dreamers, and you have particularly the categories of female participants, the westerly women, such as my apprentice, the northerly women, the southerly women, and so forth. All of this is an elaborate description of a warrior's party, and in the bringing forth to the world today, in the Neo-Taltec sorcery, these descriptions, Castaneda also proposed a technique which he called dreaming together. That is what the myth of the descent of the hero twins really describes. That is what is really veiled and encoded inside that myth. It's not a story of two male warrior shamans. It is a story of one male warrior shaman, Hunabfu, and one female warrior shaman, Ishbalanke, Black Jaguar. And the trick in that name is that the ish is used to connote the feminine gender. Even you can go and read this. The scholars of Maya linguistics will tell you this. The clue is that that myth was actually a description, or is actually taken in its true essence, that myth is a description of a shamanic practice of dreaming together. And Castaneda spends quite a bit of time from the fifth book onward to describe these practices of dreaming together. Now, I don't have the Eagle's Gift at hand right here now. It's downstairs. But I believe that there's even a chapter called Dreaming Together, and there certainly are. There's a great deal about dreaming together. And so what does the notion of dreaming together suggest to you? And how might that relate to the request of the Colombian allies that Kundry and I present to them from our joined fingers, the two pinches joined together, holding the two mycelium strands? What does that suggest? The two strands are the two strands of dreaming together, one from a man and one from a woman. And it is my shamanic intuition that the rite that is now being performed in the underworld is a recreation of that shamanic ritual that is behind the muddled and disguised mythology of the Popol Vuh. And that the objective of the Colombian allies is to use all their power, that is to say, the power that they have accumulated over many generations as allies to human animals, to restore to us in perfect operational form the technique of dreaming together so that we can use it in the Gaian navigation experiment and beyond that in the correction of the divine Sophia. Dreaming together must be restored to humanity. And when it is restored, there comes with it the possibility for men and women working in pairs to retrieve an enormous amount of the shamanic lore that was not destroyed, because it's indestructible, but that was removed from human access by the predators and perpetrators of the salvationist virus. They had to do that, and in certain respect they knew exactly what they were doing. Because any human animals who have this magic and can put it into action can, without question, achieve the total and final defeat of that virus and the total and final elimination of those who would carry it and who would infect this world with that horrific ideology of domination and racial supremacy. So that's the battle, you see, and we're not alone now. As we watch the ascent of the Black Jaguar, we prepare ourselves for what comes from the descent of the Jaguar. So, my proposal to you is to observe Black Jaguar rising. And every time you do, observe her, Venus, that planet, with your first attention. Bring this material forward out of your second attention and dream it into your observation. And in the course of this winter and the spring of 2014, concluding the 3 years of the GNA, the opportunity comes to see how this magic comes back to us. And it doesn't come back automatically. It doesn't come back arbitrarily. It comes back because it is being brought back to us by our non-human allies on this planet. They never betrayed this experiment. They never were deceived about this experiment. And it is to them that we can look now and in the future for the perfect restoration of the dreaming powers of the Wisdom Goddess.